Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the ASEP Equal Chest Pain Initiative. I'm your host, Dr. Jason Woods. Today, we're going to be focusing on cardiac biomarkers and their usefulness, as well as some of the practical implications associated with them. Our facilitator, as he has been for this entire project, is going to be Dr. Philip Levy, who's a professor of emergency medicine at Wayne State. And then our two special guests today are going to be Dr. Frank Peacock, who's also a professor of emergency medicine at Baylor and is a clinical expert in biomarkers and their use. And our second guest will be Dr. Rob Christensen from the University of Maryland, also a professor of emergency medicine and an expert in the laboratory medicine side of cardiac biomarkers. I'm going to throw this over to Phil to get us started.
Today, we're going to be talking about biomarker testing in chest pain, past, present, and future. So the first question we're going to pose is going to go to Frank. And Frank, as a clinician, what makes an ideal chest pain biomarker?
Now, I'm going to start with a story that I think everybody worries about and I've seen happen in my ER. And it's about Jane. And Jane is just your average middle-aged woman who shows up in the ER at 7 o'clock on a Monday night. And it's an ER and it's Monday, so you know what that means. And she says about an hour ago, she started throwing up and she blames it on the bad sushi her daughter gave her. So her daughter brings her in about an hour later and she shows up in the ER. And, you know, you're a regular doc. You get an EKG and some lights and a CBC and she's middle-aged. So you get a troponin and she gets an IV and 4 milligrams of Zofran and a liter of saline and you wait. And, it's busy. You're off seeing some more patients. She gets wasn't one of the sickest ones. The EKG looked okay. So about 3.5 hours later, the daughter comes and points, hey, she wants to go home. She feels better. And you go back and you talk to her and she looks great. It's like, it seems reasonable. This was a food poisoning problem. And so you pack her up and you let her go home at about 1 a.m. At 6 o'clock that morning, Jane's daughter hears a crash and goes into the bathroom and finds her mother collapsed on the floor. She calls 911 immediately, and 4 minutes later, the paramedics are there, which is really quite good, and she's in VTAC. I mean, they put the quick-look paddles on her, and there it is. So they defibrillate her, but it doesn't work, and they defibrillate her again, and it doesn't work, and so they intubate her and start CPR and do the regular stuff, and they defibrillate a little bit later, and she gets a rhythm back, and at that point, everyone's very happy, and they pop her into the ambulance, and en route, they do an EKG, and it looks like this, and this is not a question. This is a gigantic MI.
And for everyone listening at home, just go ahead for effect. Imagine the worst diffuse ST elevation MI that you have ever seen.
So they call head, transfer the EKG to the cardiology. He looks at it, goes straight to the cath lab. They skip the ER. Her door-to-balloon time is 27 minutes, and the cardiologists are high-fiving each other. This is the best thing that's ever happened, and they think they're great, and they're wonderful. The only problem is Jane never wakes up. 17 minutes of warm ischemic time is too long for her brain. She goes from the hospital to a nursing home where she spends the next 4 years until she dies of aspiration pneumonia. The only person who's happy in this whole story is the cardiologist who's got the door-to-balloon time of 27 minutes and the paramedics who helped that happen. Jane's family is not happy, and the emergency doctor who sent her home is not happy either. And so that brings us to the question is, what went wrong here? This is something that every emergency doctor sees every single day. It is the number one diagnosis in most emergency departments, and if it's not number one, it's number two is the most frequent diagnosis we see. Here's the trouble. If you think that myocardial ischemia is a middle-aged white guy holding his chest and sweaty, you're going to miss a lot of MIs. In fact, it's estimated that in 2018, you'll miss 423,600 MIs because a third of MIs have no chest pain. And so this is our world, and this is why we need a marker. It's critical in these common, vague, nonspecific symptoms. The other problem with the emergency department is my favorite song, closing time. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here because at about 4 hours into my ER visit, you've got to go somewhere. If not home, then I admit you, but you can't stay in my department, which creates the challenge that we all have, which is I can admit everybody at 4 hours and insurance companies will sort that out, or I can discharge everybody and God will sort them out. But none of these are adequate or appropriate answers. And so what do we do? And I call this game emergency medicine roulette. Some people have to go home. How can we get this right that we're most accurate in our dispositions? Because if we don't, it harms the patient. And it's not cool for us, because what happens to an emergency doctor who gets this wrong? You get to meet Judge Judy.
The risk involved with this stuff is pretty scary. So let's chat a little bit about solutions. If you were going to design an ideal biomarker, what qualities would you say are required?
Well, the first thing I want is I want it to be very sensitive, because sensitive means no false negatives. And when the test is negative, I can send them home, and I don't ever want to be wrong about that. If you remember troponin in the old days, in other words, 5 years ago, when it wasn't a very good marker, we would do zeros, three, six, nine, sometimes longer measurements, because it just didn't have very good low-level sensitivity. It has now gotten much better. The more sensitive it is, the better. And I'll make that case this way. If you look at sensitivity, it's true positive divided by true positives over false negatives. And as an emergency doc, I am completely abhorrent to false negatives, because when it's negative, I believe it's true, I send them home, I hurt them. So emergency docs really want sensitivity. This is in conflict with the opposite problem here, because you can't have both. You get either sensitivity or specificity. Pick one. And if you're a cardiologist, you really don't want false positives, because what happens with the false positives is they are hospitalized and share that risk, and then you cath them. And cathing patients is not necessarily harmless. It's a diagnostic test, but it has a dye load associated with it. Patients can have anaphylaxis from the dye. Occasionally there's a dissection, and you actually create an MI when there wasn't one, or you can hurt the groin or wherever you enter the catheter. So they want no false positives. So we have two different spectrums of the troponin continuum, from sensitivity to specificity. From the emergency medicine point of view, sensitivity is king. From the cardiologist, it's specificity.
Just to throw one other thing into the mix, you really want those high levels of sensitivity and specificity, again, depending on where you work, as you discussed, at low levels of the marker so that you're not having to repeat levels at 6, 10, 12 hours out, just to be sure that you're not missing a rise or to get into the place where the assay can actually detect it.
So now what we're buying is we're getting speed, and speed is cool. I love speed. I'm an emergency doctor. That's my favorite song. But the problem with speed is that we have historically gotten it by point-of-care markers. And point-of-care markers were great when the lab test was fairly insensitive, because point-of-care markers, the dirty secret is they're not as sensitive as the lab. So if you're doing a one-and-done, can you use a point-of-care? And I'm not certain on that. If they've had long symptoms, meaning more than 6 hours, the guidelines say yes. And the reason we put 6 hours out there is because it takes that long for the troponin elevation to be detected. But if a patient's had symptoms solidly for 6 straight hours or 8 or 9 or 10 hours, do you really need multiple troponins? And probably not. And do you really need an extremely low level troponin? Well, that's a question. What the data does say is when the troponin is very, very low, that a single troponin or two troponins with very low levels are highly sensitive for excluding acute coronary syndrome. But when you look at the numbers, they're not perfect.
What about the other side, specificity?
Do we need specificity? Well, you can't have them both. I already talked about how we're getting much better sensitivity. That occurs at the cost of specificity. But if I'm talking about the perfect marker, specificity is cool, because what happens when they're positive? They don't go home. And the question for you is, how many ICU beds can you fill up with your false positive troponins before you're at the breaking point? And most ERs I've ever been to have a finite number, and we don't want to test that over includes patients into a high-risk strata. So specificity becomes important. Now, the good news about cardiac troponin is when cardiac troponin is elevated, it's from the heart. There is no other place that causes an elevation. It may not be from an MI. It may be a consequence of their renal failure or their heart failure. They have bad pneumonia. But everybody with an elevated troponin does bad, just it may not be a myocardial infarction.
I asked a little bit earlier about what your ideal biomarker would be, and I want to get back to that a little bit. So if you are designing it, what kind of cut points do you want as far as where you're going to set your detection level or your risk level? At what kind of risk tolerance would you have?
I want to support the 1% as a reasonable cut point, at which point you could send patients home if the sensitivity is 99%. And this comes from the Premier database. It's a study that we did looking at what happens when you get hospitalized. And we wanted to figure out, if you didn't have a disease, but you got hospitalized anyway, what are the risks in that situation? So we looked at the Premier database. It's a large industry database. And we looked at about 7,000 patients with pulmonary embolus. 1,900 of them were low risk. And low risk pulmonary embolus patients can be sent home. We've studied that and proven it. And so we match those low-risk patients with short stay to low-risk patients with longer stays. In other words, people discharged immediately versus those hospitalized. And we just followed their stay to see how many hospital-acquired conditions they had. And what we found out, there was no PE differences. Nobody died of PE. All these people were low risk. They all did well. They're all alive in 30 days. What we found out is those in the blue bars, they were discharged from the ER. Those in the red bars were moved. And what you have is about 800% increase in hospital-acquired conditions if you're hospitalized, because you don't have C. diff at home. You don't get MRSA. You don't get hospital-acquired pneumonia. And so the point is that at some point, you risk patients by putting them unnecessarily in the hospital. So if your assay has a 99% sensitivity, that means 1% of the time you send them home inappropriately, 99% of the time you discharge them appropriately. That 1% is a risk, but the 99% will not be subject to hospital acquired conditions. And so that seems to be a reasonable breakpoint. So I want some specificity. I want some speed. How about costs and where does that come down? There are not a lot of costs known about high sensitivity troponin currently. There are two trials where they looked at the cost per life year gain. This was done in England. That's why it's in pound. And it's about 5,000 pounds per cost of life year gain, which is well below the cut point in the United States is generally $50,000 is the value of a year of life. There are a lot of personal judgments you can make about that, but it's generally accepted. And then you have to say, well, are those quality years? And so they did that on assay also, and you can see that it's about 7,300 pounds. And so the pound is like $1.50 now. So it's about 10 grand per cost of quality of life years saved. And that's still well within the reasonable numbers. This was also done. What we come from that is that there truly is a value to this, that to a high sensitivity troponin. It's probably the closest thing to a perfect marker that we have existing now, if you consider the other markers like CBCs and creatinines that we use.
All right, we're going to send this over to you, Rob. What makes an ideal chest pain marker to you as a laboratory expert?
So I'll just start off with a definition of a biomarker, which is just a measurable characteristic that reflects the severity or presence of some disease state. And we can think of many biomarkers. The electrocardiogram, for example, is a biomarker that reflects the physiological state of an organism. But today, what we're going to talk about is biochemical markers. And I'm going to sort of goop what much of my comments will be about, and that is cardiac troponin, because what we teach is, and I think Frank alluded to this earlier, is that when you see troponin increase, you think heart. Now, there are some occasions where there are false positive cardiac troponin from not mixing tubes properly, et cetera, but I think they're really quite rare. And cardiac troponin is really a remarkable biomolecule because, again, when you see an increase in either cardiac-specific troponin I or cardiac troponin T, you can think heart.
But again, reinforcing that cardiac troponin is a cardiac-specific marker, not a disease-specific marker. So while it might tell you which organ is unhappy, it doesn't always tell you exactly what the cause of that is.
So there used to be a time when myoglobin and CK-MB, many of us trained in the CK-MB era, were felt to have, and as well as CK total, were felt to have value and really added information to what a cardiac troponin could bring. But I think studies like this in the New England Journal of Medicine back in 2009 have dispelled those notions. The last iteration of the AHA-ACC guidelines show that with contemporary troponin assays, that is lab quality assays, and not all assays run, as I think Frank made very clear, for example, many of the point of care assays are not what we would call contemporary troponin assays. But when you're using a lab quality assay, the CKMB and myoglobin are not useful for diagnosis of ACS, and in fact may be either misleading, but certainly contribute cost to the care of that patient. So cardiac troponin is the name of the game. Now we have to remember that these universal definitions of MI, there have been three documents now, are consensus documents. So they're not necessarily evidence-based.
Can you clarify for me if all of the laboratory quality troponin tests that are available out there are the same? And within that, what does it mean to be a high sensitivity assay?
Let's just start off by asking ourselves, well, are all cardiac troponin assays created equal? And the answer to that is no. They're very heterogeneous. And this is something that we have to realize. We'll see this several times in the next few minutes. These higher sensitivity or contemporary assays, one of the things they really bring to the party is much better precision. One of the really important things that high sensitivity cardiac troponin assays bring, they bring both high accuracy and high precision. Now, one of the things that is going to be interesting going into the high sensitivity era is that we are going to have sex-specific cutoffs, or that women are going to have lower values A really neat thing that high sensitivity assays are going to bring to us is this unit thing. What is easier, to get $0.05 to buy a piece of candy, or is it easier to get 5 cents? So the high sensitivity assays are going to be reported as integers rather than as fractions.
Now, let's just clarify here that when we are talking about these assays, the sensitivity that we're referring to is the level at which the marker can actually be detected, and not the statistical sensitivity. We did talk about that in the first half of this discussion, but I want to make sure everybody is clear which sensitivity we're talking about and when. Frank, we're going to go back to you. Knowing that we have these high sensitivity troponin measurements available, what will this mean for patient care?
I'm going to start by talking about the Accelerated Diagnostic Protocol, an ADP. And the point of an ADP is it's not to identify patients who are having an event or even being at risk for having an event, but it's to identify patients who have nothing related to the heart. In other words, they'd be candidates for discharge. And that is where high sensitivity troponins really are going to help us. We're going to get pushback from the cardiology community about them being too sensitive and having too many false positives, and there are a lot of emergency docs who run around and say that now. That's looking at one end of the spectrum. A highly sensitive troponin will have a much larger impact on our patient population than we currently do. And it comes from this data. This was done by Martin Than. He looked at about 3,500 patients, and what they did is a 0 and a 2 hour point of care troponin. And this was back in the days with not a very sensitive troponin. And if they had a TEMI score less than 1, in other words, a TEMI score of 0, and a non-diagnostic EKG, that would define them as a low-risk population. So with that, they took their 3,500 patients to see what would happen. They used the TEMI score. I'm not a huge fan of the TEMI score, but it is one of the scores with a fairly large amount of data in the emergency department on prospective evaluation.
And if you want to know more about this score and how it compares to others that are out there, definitely check out our previous podcast, which is all about risk stratification using cardiac scores.
Timmy looks at this. There's seven factors. It's being old with lots of risk factors, known disease, EKG or troponin changes, taking an aspirin, we're having an angina event in the last 24 hours, two angina events last. Each one's a point. The nice part about Timmy is it's 2-week outcomes, which is a real emergency medicine outcome. It's not 2 months or 2 years. It's next 2 weeks, you die or get cast. So a reasonable outcome. And what Martin Than showed in that trial is that using the Accelerated Diagnostic Protocol, they could identify about 10% of the patients who could leave the ER immediately and they would all be alive and well in 30 days. And people said, well, 10%, that's not that many. Is it really worth the headache? Well, if you do the math on that, how many people show up in the emergency department with chest pain a year? 10% of that population is millions. So that is where he got TEMI of 0, low-risk patients is 10%, 30-day MACE was under 1%. This was then immediately repeated by Louise Cullen and Martin Than. They used a better troponin. They could discharge 25% of the patients, and their 30-day outcome, their adverse cardiac event rate, 30 days was 0.25%. So this is pretty good. That means 1 out of 4 chest pain patients you see can go home. If you look at where we sit now, this is a series of troponin low-risk accelerated diagnostic protocols that have been done. ASPECT was the first one, not a very good troponin. ADAPT was repeated with a better troponin. ADAPT is about where the U.S. troponins currently live. You can send home 20% of the patients using that criteria. And then if you go up from there, a PACE takes you 38, and now TRAPID MI, which is using the new Roche troponin T, 63% of the patients who are risk stratified as being low risk with early serial troponins and non-diagnostic EKGs can be discharged. So what we're looking at is changing the way we do chest pain. They don't get admitted. They don't get admitted to rule out MI because you've ruled out MI. The only reason to admit them now is because you're worried they have unstable angina and they need a stress test because you want to make sure they're not high risk. This is the ADAPT and PACE trials. What you see here, this is in about 1,600 patients who were in the DAP trial. That was an Australasian trial. A PACE was done in Europe, about 1,000 patients. And with a higher sensitive troponin, you could then send home TEMI zeros and TEMI ones. Whereas before it was just TEMI zeros, now you can send home both that population. And you can see they send home about 40% of the patients, and 30-day MACEs are still under 1% with a higher troponin. So now you're getting near the 50-50 club, where half the chest pain leaves my department.
Are there any concerns with some of these rapid pathways of measuring samples too early? I mean, at some point, even with the most sensitive assay possible, there still has to be cardiac muscle damage to produce the troponin.
This is really important, is how do you make it work in real clinical practice. One thing I want to point out is that when we talk about these very rapid rule-out protocols where patients at 0 and 2 or 0 and 1 even, if you look at those trials, the average patient shows up about 3 hours into their chest pain. And so that's where you have to use the studies that are out there and apply them to the population at hand. If you have a patient who's had 1 hour of chest pain, there is probably no troponin that will detect that because you've got a nanogram of troponin that has to dilute itself into all the blood volume you've got. And that's going to, it'll be there, but very, very low levels until it's had time to rise. And so if you have a very, very early presentation, you have to be careful to applying all these things that I'm going to go through risk scores right now. The studies, the average time of presentation is 3 hours. So if they're below that, you probably need to wait until they hit that mark to be considered them protocol candidates. So here's the heart score. It's gotten a lot of play in emergency medicine. It seems to make sense. It uses EKG, age risks, and troponin, which are all objective, and then adds history, which is not objective. Now, one of the challenges for emergency physicians is that in every head-to-head comparison of outcomes versus emergency physicians' gestalt, we lose. Emergency physicians tend to admit way too many people. So when we're talking about discharging people, here you have a risk-averse specialty trying to take on a new strategy. And the heart score, and the reason it's not my favorite score, is because of this first subjective question immediately decreases the number of patients we send home because we tend to put people in higher risks than they really are because we're really seriously worried about their risk. But the heart score does have support in the literature, and it is probably one of the better performing scores, and it certainly beats gestalt. So
we're not going to dig too far into scores because we spoke at length about it on the previous podcast, but you've mentioned several that you don't really like. Do you have a particular score that you prefer to use?
EDAX is my more favorite score because it's all objective. There is nothing subjective. It's the history the patient has. It is the age, sex, and their symptoms. And their symptoms are pretty objective. You ask them, they either sweat or they didn't. It rated, it didn't. Gets worse with inspiration or doesn't. And it gets worse with palpation or not, and that's it. If your score are low with either the heart score or the EDAX score and you have serial troponins or negative non-diagnostic EKG, you've met the criteria for an accelerated diagnostic protocol and you're a discharge candidate. Now, we will talk a little about what scores are low means. This was done, Adam Singer and I did this analysis in about 450 patients. We prospectively made doctors get the scores. And that's a nightmare because there's a whole bunch of data points they have to collect. But the reason to do that is you can't fake it. You can't do retrospective analyses. And these studies that do that are weak because how do you find out the doctor's decision of how high risk the patient was in the heart score if you didn't collect it in real time? So throw all those retrospective trials away. But prospectively, this is what you get for comparing scores for the diagnosis of acute coronary syndromes. So did the patient rule in later? And you can see that the TEMI score is what you want to have here is the highest curve up to the left upper corner of the area's receiver operator error characteristic curve. And EDAX is the highest in the yellow line. And heart score with two troponins, that's heart two, is the second highest of the green lines. And everything below that performs less well. And we're talking about less well being sensitivity, specificity for the diagnosis of ACS. In this mixed population, using the cutoff that is published, and so for heart score, it's 3 or less, it still missed MIs. EDAX, less than 16, it missed 1% of MIs. And so this is not where we want to be in terms of missing MI. And so what we did with our data set is we set the sensitivity at 99%, which meant that the cut points changed. And the heart score with a cut point of less of 2 or less safely sent home patients 99% sensitivity for ACS, 19% of the time, so 1 out of 5. Look at TEMI sent home, with a cut point of 0, sent home 7% of patients. It's almost not worth doing. And then EDAX, using a cut point of 12, sent home about a third of the patients. So heart and EDAX become the best two scores to use for discharging patients safely in the setting of troponins. So it really does change where we are in the world. I always like to leave an algorithm. This is not validated in an entire scale. Bits and pieces of it are. And that's why I say up there it's pretty much unvalidated. But it's easy. Somebody comes in, you get an EKG. If it's positive, you go to the cath lab. If it's non-diagnostic, you get a 0 and a 2 or 3 hour troponin. Anyone's positive, you're done. I don't necessarily call those MIs. It depends on the clinical presentation, but I keep them around while I figure out why their troponin's elevated. And if it's due to their sepsis, then they're going to get better sepsis care and they go to the MICU. But the idea is this is a clinical diagnosis. If the 0 and 2 or 3 hour troponins are negative and the EDAX is under 12, that's a candidate for early discharge. Now, that means that they have nothing else going on. They don't really have a PE also, but that's responsibility clinically to put this together. If the EDAX is high, in other words, they're not a candidate to go home, they need a myocardial perfusion imaging, a stress test or CTA or something like that. And the data we have requires TIMI that says they can't be too high a risk, because at which point there is no point in doing a CT angio if you're a TIMI of 6, because it's going to be positive and you have to go on to a test after that. So there is an upper limit to risk, and if it's really high risk, and that's TIMI 4, at that point, I just consider those patients needing to be admitted and possibly having a cardiology consult. If you think about who's a TIMI of 4, they've got a stent and they've had 2 prior MIs, and those patients who came in with chest pain probably aren't great candidates for discharge.
So we're at the end of our time here, but I think a nice summary statement on this is that we are in an era right now where troponin is the present and foreseeable future biomarker of choice for chest pain, with modifications in the sensitivity of the troponin assay and more specifically approval of existing high sensitivity assays in the United States by the FDA is really going to change the market and change the way we approach care of these individuals. We'll be able to much more reliably tell who doesn't have myocardial injury. There may be some uncertainty when the test is positive because patients may or may not have coronary artery disease, but that's where we get into this idea that nothing happens in isolation. So just taking the biomarker alone, if it's below the limit of detection, we can at least have some certainty that nothing bad is going on at that point in time, but it should be done within the context of other clinical variables. Just because you don't have a heart attack now doesn't mean you're not at risk for a heart attack or coronary artery disease.
That was a wonderful summary, Phil. And there you have it, the ASEP Equal Chest Pain Initiative Biomarker Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you next time.